This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. How well represented are women in the permanent collection of the North Carolina Museum of Art? According to curator Jennifer Dassel, only about 25% of the artists in that collection are women, which is a surprising figure in 2011. But get this, nearly all of the pieces by women in the collection are contemporary works. When Jennifer Dassel set out to design a show for the museum's new North Carolina gallery, she found herself drawn to that 25%, and she noticed that much of the new work by women artists focuses on women. And so the new show, Mirror Image, Women Portraying Women, was born. All of the artists in the show live in North Carolina, but they aren't necessarily local. Many have national and international reputations. The show is meant to highlight the breadth and depth of female talent in the state. Two of the artists joined me in the studio today. Ellen O'Hara Slavik, Susan Harbage Page, have both been guests on the program before. Welcome back. Good to have both of you here.
Great to be here.
Curator Jennifer Dassel joins me as well. Hello, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the title, Mirror Image.
Well, the first thing the Mirror Image comes from is obviously the connection that women have to other artists and representing themselves. They also attempt to represent women as a whole. Secondly, it actually stems from a work that we have in our permanent collection at the North Carolina Museum of Art, a painting by Maud Gatewood entitled Mirror Image. So it's really a play on two different things.
Tell us more about Maud Gatewood.
Maud Gatewood, I think a lot of people consider her to be one of the first women of North Carolina art. She was very prolific in art for almost 50 years. She was born in Yanceyville in North Carolina, and then she'd worked all the way across the state and also up in Virginia as well. And into her death in 2004, she was very active as an artist. And then upon her death in 2004, she bequested a number of items to the North Carolina Museum of Art, and Mirror Image was one of those works that ended up in our permanent collection.
There's a little story behind that work, too, isn't there? First of all, describe that work for us.
It is an image of a woman. It seems almost as if we are sneaking up on her somehow. It's almost a little subversive. It's an image of a woman who's topless and looks like she's just blow-drying her hair, stuck in a moment of getting ready, maybe for work or a day out. And all we see of her is actually what's being reflected in a mirror.
And it's interesting that she's not posing. I mean, it's deliberate that this is a woman being caught in the act.
Exactly. It's very intimate moment.
It's also, there's a story behind this particular painting because it didn't really see the light of day until it made its way to the museum.
Exactly. We don't really know the exact meaning behind it, but we do know that it had some sort of personal significance for Maud Gatewood in that this work was never sold, and it was kept in her personal possession, actually held in her bedroom until her death, until the time that it made out to the Museum of Art itself.
So she either felt this shouldn't be out there, but the fact is she was hanging it. I mean, it hung in her bedroom.
Exactly.
So it's something she really loved. And again, the sort of this idea of intimacy, particularly when we know that about it, is kind of a fascinating story about this particular painting. And the title, Susan, this is your first time, the first time your work has been shown at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and I know you've seen the show. How does it feel to have your work there?
It's great to have my work there. The installation is beautiful, and I was really excited when Jennifer called me and said, oh, I want to put a piece of your Postcards from Home series in here, because it's tough work. And so I thought it was really great that they were willing to take on this subject.
Well, talk about it. It is tough work, and it's racially charged. Describe the photograph for us.
Well, the work has always been described or often been described as seductively disturbing. And it's what I've been doing is taking the traditional old KKK hood, since we don't wear that white hood anymore, and asking questions about what it looks like today. What does that hood look like today? So I'm recreating that in contemporary fabrics. The particular piece that Jennifer chose is very elusive in a way, because it shows, you wouldn't know it was a hood unless you saw the hood that I made in my studio, because this is a close-up.
Let me describe it as very, from my point of view, very feminine looking. It's pretty. It's pretty. It's not at all menacing in the way that a hood is meant to be. And it looks like an attractive piece until you realize that it's absolutely in the shape of a Klan hood.
Yeah, it's absolutely in the shape of a Klan hood, but it's made with a different material. It's this really beautiful, veily, embroidered material. So it really implicates women in perpetrating these acts of racism. And it reminds me of somebody who I might see at church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And they have that beautiful embroidered linen suit on. And, you know, they're at church and they're sitting there. And then all of a sudden they turn to you and they say something really hateful, yeah, or something that's, you know, not so direct, but has an altered meaning underneath or a second meaning. And I think that one of the important things about my work is that it really does implicate women, and it looks at women and how racism comes from the home. One of the things I do is I sew those Klan hoods myself out of the contemporary fabrics. And, you know, that's, women did that in the 1920s when there was the revival of racism and the KKK in the South and throughout the United States. But so I'm talking about that coming from the domestic setting, how it gets passed on, how we all participate, and trying to talk about that today. The intent of my work is to really provoke a conversation so that you're standing in front of that image and you go, well, you know, am I a part of this?
Yeah,
Do I perpetrate this? Is it part of my language? Do, you know?
Well, and if I ask that my voice be included, because the voice of women has been excluded for so long, if I ask for my voice to be included in the story of history, it's going to be the whole voice, and that includes some of the moments that we don't want to recall.
Right. There's a lot of things we don't want to look at, but until we look at those, we cannot see where we are today. And one of the things I've been doing is really looking at women throughout my whole career. I started out working in a textile mill and worked with a group of African-American women there. So I think I've been addressing groups of women over the years. And I think that's what a lot of women do.
Ellen, tell us about your piece, the name of the piece, and describe it for us.
I have two photographs in the show from a series called Workers Dreaming. And they actually acquired four of those pieces. Two are of men and two are of women. So the two that are in the show are of women. And one of them is my favorite one of the series, and it's of Matilda Lambie, who's cleaning the Fred Wilson installation at the Venice Biennale in Italy a few years ago. And he has this black and white checked bathroom tile and these two inkwells, black inkwells. He's an African-American artist. And people weren't supposed to dip their fingers in the inkwells, but they kept dipping their fingers in the inkwells. So this woman who was a worker at the Biennale had to sit there and clean it with Windex over and over and over all day long. So she's on her hands and knees cleaning it with Windex. And the other one is four African-American cooks from the casino in Shreveport, Louisiana. And they're on a break and they have check pants on and their chef hats and they're having cigarettes and sitting there with blood on their aprons. And it's from the series Workers Dreaming that, like Susan's work, is trying to get people to think about provocative and things, under-recognized things, workers that you, you know, most people don't even treat with respect or say hello to or even acknowledge as a fellow equal human being. And most of the workers I photograph are underpaid and under-recognized, and they are from all over the world, and both men and women, all ages. There is even a banker. I mean, they're not all underpaid, but trying to get people to think about the service industry and workers and labor.
It provokes those conversations and also the role of art in that discussion. Mm-hmm. And it's a discussion that will continue on The State of Things Today, talking with Jennifer Dassel, Ellen O'Hara Slavik, Susan Harbidge Page about Mirror Image, a show at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Our conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking today about Mirror Image, Women Portraying Women, an exhibition at the North Carolina Museum of Art. With me are the exhibit's curator, Jennifer Dassel, and two participating artists, Susan Harbidge Page and Ellen O'Hara Slavik. Jennifer, another artist included in the show is Margaret Sartor, a photographer in Durham. Tell us about her pieces.
We have three pieces of Margaret Sartor's in Mirror Image. We have a number of them in our permanent collection. And these three all come from the same series, which is entitled Close to Home. And this is a series that she's done for about the past 20 years in which she returns to her hometown to photograph her family, a lot of times her children, her nieces and nephews, sisters, brothers, her parents. It's really her extended family in general, but the three images that we represent here are of her nieces and her daughter. They're three separate images of the little girls in play or at rest, and it's really her way of not only photographing their childhood, but really going back and examining her own childhood. And there's a quote in her introduction to that exhibition in which she says, no matter the path I pursue in my work, it's always the relationship to family and the world of my upbringing that shapes and defines my perspective. And I think that's true for many of us. Where we came from really defines who we become, who we grow up to be. So she's defined by the girl that she once was, really transformed her into the woman that she is now.
Also, Caroline Vaughn, there are, I guess you can say, a span of generations, or is a span of generations here. Caroline Vaughn, a photographer who's been working for 40 years, and her piece goes back, it was done in 1971, is that right?
1971, that's correct. After she graduated from Duke in 1971, she went out on a road trip across the country to the Bay Area in California, where she met with one of her idols, who was Imogen Cunningham, a very famous American photographer, who was in her 80s at the time, and they developed a fast friendship. And during that first trip, she took a few very intimate photos of Imogen, and they're very... very intimate, very non-posed, very candid works. And there's one image of her in particular where she turns to the camera and the flashbulb really illuminates her as she is. You know, we see the wrinkles, we see the wispy gray hair. And it's really a very beautiful, very graceful portrait of an aging woman.
I want to get a sense, too, from Ellen and Susan, what are some of your the pieces that stand out in your minds in this exhibit? Susan?
Roxana Perez Mendez's piece, Caridad, is really, I think, one of the most striking pieces for me in the exhibition. She uses a holographic process, and it really does reach out to women across cultures. It's really addressing immigrants to Puerto Rico from Cuba and the things that are left behind. And it's this image of Roxana in a boat, and she's rowing and rowing and rowing and rowing, and then she's emptying water out of the boat. And I think it operates on so many levels, and it's such a poetic piece. It talks about immigration into Puerto Rico, but I also think it addresses women's struggles, you know, that we're still talking about these days. You know, women still make 18% less than men, and we still don't have the main leadership roles. And so that piece for me is just so poetic and so beautiful. And I think the process, and actually the installation, I've seen it in other spots, and the installation at the North Carolina Museum of Art really highlights this process that she has resurrected. And the process was used to be used for appearing and disappearing people on stage. And so I think that also references the roles of women. You know, sometimes we're seen, sometimes we're not seen. I think we have the education now, and things have really changed. I think about my mother when she went to Ohio State University. All of her professors were men. She said, I was a sculptor, and all of the other students were men, and the professors wouldn't look at my work. And now I think about Roxana Perez Mendez as a professor at UNC teaching sculpture to her students. And so things have really changed for women in the arts, and I think that's one of the indications that I see in this exhibition that Jennifer's put together, that we really have come a long way.
Things have changed for women in the arts. It's titled Mirror Image, Women Portraying Women. Do we still need to do that? Do we still need to curate exhibits that point out gender, that underscore the fact that this is women about women? Ellen?
Well, I mean, I think we need everything. I mean, it's just like speech. The more speech you have, the more speech you have. So I think we need to have as many exhibitions as we can have. And I support any show that's about people of color or women or any sort of group. But it's a double-edged sword, because then it you do run the risk of being sort of ghettoized and it being dismissed as a special show for a special interest group, or, you know, that we're women artists before we're artists. And so there is that dilemma, but I would participate in any show that was only women or that was a feminist show. I think we still need it. I think we need to talk about feminism in a much smarter way, because most of my students claim not to be feminists, although they couldn't be making the work they're making without the predecessors, all the feminist predecessors that came before them. But I don't even know if they know what it means. You know, we're in this age of post-feminism and post-black, which I don't believe. I don't buy that.
Let me go around the table, though. Is it important to talk about that? Is it important to identify yourself as a feminist if that ground has already been laid, if that groundwork has been done, and now we're moving into that next generation? We don't have to think about it anymore. We don't have to point out.
But we do. I mean, we still make less than men, and there's still only 25% of women in the North Carolina collection, which actually is probably high if you compare it to other institutions across the country.
I actually think it's 25% in the contemporary collection. Okay. I think in the museum as a whole, I'm sure it's a lot less, but that's because we're looking at an art history that has been very sketchy and including women. I mean, until the late 18th century and early 19th century, women didn't even have the opportunity to pursue art as a career. It was nothing but a hobby at best. So that really didn't start turning around until the beginning of the 20th century. So we're really trying to make up for lost time now in the modern and contemporary age.
And Susan, you point out that you're a student. You put them on a quest to find out how many solo shows.
I do. I have them research on the web, solo shows, and it's about museums, all sorts of museums. They'll research international museums, national museums, and local museums. And it's about 20% women versus 80% men who have solo shows. I also have them deconstruct art magazines, and that is stunning. Every time we do that, we go through the magazines, we look at what galleries are spending their money on. They're buying full-page ads for men who have solo exhibitions, but they're not doing the same for women. They'll have women as part of their gallery exhibitions or in group shows, or they might do a solo show, but they're not going to spend the money to put that one full-page ad in Art in America. So I think that's one of the underlying issues that we haven't addressed here is like when, you know, you might do an exhibition, but when do you really spend the money to support, to push forward, to give that equality to women, to that gender equity that we're looking for?
Well, Jennifer, what drives a decision like that from the museum's point of view?
Honestly, the very first thing that we were thinking about was the space in which the exhibition was held. This is in our new dedicated North Carolina gallery, which we switch out every 6 months. And we alternate between solo exhibitions and then more thematic group shows. So when we opened the space in November, we opened with a solo exhibition of the sculptor Bob Trotman. So this exhibition naturally was always going to be a group show. And I thought, why not, if we started with a male artist, why not move into representing women artists with this show?
You have one, at least one piece in this exhibit that I think demonstrates at least some consciousness about women and their role. And it's from, I think, your youngest artist, your youngest contributor, Emily Scott Beck. Tell us about her piece.
Her work is a video piece entitled Churn. She's a recent graduate of UNC Chapel Hill's MFA program, and this was her thesis project that was on display. And it's a very interesting video. It's a short one in which women dunk their heads into a basin of water, and the camera is actually positioned underneath so that we see them with their eyes open, and they're basically yelling underwater and just saying whatever comes to mind. And it's very interesting because they release whatever tensions or whatever emotions come to the surface, but we can't understand a word that they're saying. So it is a double-edged sword, I think, also, in that they're able to finally say whatever they want, feel free enough to say it, but no one can actually hear it.
So you see, Ellen, your students, still feminism is working away, at least your students.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny when Susan gives the numbers. If you look at most of my classes are all women, but most of the teachers are still mostly men. So when does that switch happen? It happens somewhere along the line. You know, really, I would say over 75% of the students I teach in the last 16 years have been women, but still most of my colleagues are men. It's changing. We have hired some more women lately, but I don't know when that happens, you know, but it does still happen, and that's why it's important. But yeah, I think it's our job to teach. I mean, I've talked to so many people about the idea of feminism, and I don't think our students are learning it. I learned feminist theory in graduate school. I did readings in college, but in other classes, it wasn't a women's studies class. It was taught in regular classes. You got it in poetry classes, in history classes, in creative writing, in novel classes about literature. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem like they're getting that sort of education. And I don't know why.
Well,
that is, if it's a backlash or if it's this idea that we're post-feminism.
You think it's the way some people have co-opted the word feminism to mean something very negative, very, you know, that it's that people who are feminists are hate men, and that sort of backlash, other people who are supporting the patriarchal society.
Yeah, the definition
sort of trying
has
to push that
troubled,
forward.
Right.
There's always that issue of
But don't
that.
You have to know, if you're going to study contemporary art and if you're going to work in the field of contemporary art, don't you need to know the cultural milieu? And how can you get through that without having thought about feminism?
Yeah, well, I mean,
even as a sort of an abstract cultural idea.
Yeah, and I think that's why there are so many women artists who are photographing each other, mm-hmm. not only themselves, but mm-hmm. each other, because so much of art history has been by men, about men, or even the images of women by men are very highly eroticized, objectified, sexist in a very particular way. And not that we're not erotic or sexual beings, of course, but we're more than that. And I think it's important, and it is a reaction, a positive reaction, that we photograph ourselves and each other in reaction to that.
It's a shift in the power structure. If a woman is photographing a woman, it's a different power mm-hmm. structure than if a man is photographing a woman. And for years and years, the history of photography has been men photographing mostly women. And so that's a whole shift that I see in this exhibition that I think is a very powerful shift in the history of photography.
And the consumers for those images have traditionally been men as well. Yeah. So these works that are created by women, that are of women now, are images that they're keeping for themselves or for the consumption of other women as well.
But when a piece is self-consciously about image, about the image of women or a woman, more than other themes, when it's self-consciously about image, when does it cross the line from being a reflection of a cultural truth to just narcissism?
Well, we were talking about it earlier. Amelia Jones has a great essay about narcissism in reference to Hannah Wilke's work. And Hannah Wilke was an incredible artist in the 60s and 70s who photographed herself naked, and she was accused of being a narcissist and, you know, just a self-promoter because she was too beautiful. Why is she photographing? Like, if she wasn't beautiful, it would have been okay. It was so bizarre. And then she ends up getting cancer, just like her mother, and she photographs herself, these huge color, very disturbing images of herself dying of cancer, and they're really troubling. Her hair's falling out, and it's almost as if she responds to all these attacks, and now she's not beautiful, but of course she is still gorgeous. And the essay is about how interesting it is that narcissism has become mostly an insult thrown at women, even though Narcissus was a male. And how did that flip happen, right? And it is this that we live in this sort of I think we still do live in a patriarchal society. Yes, it's better, but it's still one. But I don't think it's like hysteria. I think narcissism mm-hmm. and hysteria, a lot of feminists or at least women artists have used those as liberating ideas, and that you can actually undermine or subvert the paradigm, the dominant paradigm, by using these things that are dismissed as, you know, bad things, right, but they're not. They're powerful if you know how to use them, if you know how to employ them.
Yeah, and actually, I think we live in a society today that's hyper-masculine and hyper-feminine. And I think that's really affecting the way we see ourselves and the way our young children are going to be seeing themselves and the expectations that they have. I mean, I watched my son grow up with these, you know, toys that were these hyper-masculine, you know, objects with huge muscles that he is never, ever going to have. So what does that do to his idea of self, and what's happening to young women today with the idea of self that's being presented in magazines and on TV and on the internet, and these expectations that, you know, actually women are supposed to all look alike if you look at the magazines. So I just think there are a lot of questions.
Well, so are we moving into, is the inclusion of women now, the in greater numbers in the world of art, changing the nature of art? Are we moving to a new Aquarian convergence?
I think so. I think things are definitely getting better.
How so? What do you see?
I see a lot more, I would call it relational aesthetics, for lack of a better term, you know, interactive, more community-based, more political, but that's not just because of women. It's because of this more, I would say, postmodern, open, multiple voices are welcome, global perspective thing that women are a part of and a big part of. But yes, I do think it's changing. And I think it is more, I don't want to say celebratory, but it does empower you as any of those people, if you see yourself represented and you can represent yourself. I mean, I started photographing myself and my women friends. I mean, I am a bisexual woman. I've always been attracted to both women and men. It came out of that desire for women. And that was really important to me as a woman, to represent women in an erotic way as a woman. And it spoke about me and other women and all these other things at once. And it was because I wasn't seeing that represented. And I'm one of many, many, many people who've done this. And so, of course, that's changing it.
Jennifer, sounds like you have an exhibit that could open a few conversations.
Which was the whole point in the first place.
It's great to have all of you here. Thanks so much for being on the program today. Eleanor Harris-Levick, Susan Harbidge-Page, artist included in the show Mirror Image, Women Portraying Women, on display at the North Carolina Museum of Art through November. Jennifer Dassel is the exhibit's curator. And for more information, check out ncartmuseum.org/exhibitions. Coming up on the program, The America Play gives people the chance to pay a penny to shoot Abraham Lincoln. More on the Upstage Cabaret production after this break. Stay with us on The State of Things.